Death of an Expert Witness, Disc 8.
Chapter 3. After the last few days of intermittent rain and fitful autumn sunlight, the morning was cold, but bright, the sun unexpectedly warm against their necks. But even in the mellow light, the old rectory with its bricks the colour of raw liver under the encroaching ivy, and its ponderous porch and carved overhanging eaves, was a depressing house. The open iron gate to the drive, half off its hinges, was embedded in a straggling hedge which bordered the garden. The gravel path needed weeding. The grass of the lawn was pulled and flattened where someone had made an inexpert attempt at mowing it, obviously with a blunt machine. And the two herbaceous borders were a tangle of overgrown chrysanthemums and stunted dahlias, half choked with weeds. A child's wooden horse on wheels lay on its side at the edge of the lawn, but this was the only sign of human life. As they approached the house, however, a girl and a small boy emerged from the porch and stood regarding them. They must, of course, be Kerrison's children. And as Dalgleeshan Massingham approached, the likeness became apparent. The girl must, he supposed, be over school age, but she looked barely 16, except for a certain adult wariness about the eyes. She had straight, dark hair, drawn back from a high, spotty forehead into short, dishevelled pigtails bound with elastic bands. She wore the ubiquitous faded blue jeans of her generation, topped with a fawn sweater, loose-fitting enough to be her father's. Around her neck, Dalgleesh could glimpse what looked like a leather thong. Her grubby feet were bare, and palely striped with the pattern of summer sandals. The child, who moved closer to her at the sight of strangers, was about 3 or 4 years old, a stocky, round-faced boy with a wide nose and a gentle, delicate mouth. His face was a softer, miniature model of his father's, the brows straight and dark above the heavily lidded eyes. He was wearing a pair of tight blue shorts and an inexpertly knitted striped sweater against which he was clasping a large ball. His sturdy legs were planted in short, red Wellington boots. He tightened his hold on his ball and fixed on Dalgleesh an unblinking, disconcertingly judgmental gaze. Dalgleesh suddenly realized that he knew virtually nothing about children. Most of his friends were childless. Those who were not had learned to invite him when their demanding, peace-disturbing, egotistical offspring were away at school. His only son had died with his mother just 24 hours after birth. Although he could now hardly recall his wife's face, except in dreams, the picture of those waxen, doll-like features above the tiny, swathed body, the gummed eyelids, the secret look of self-absorbed peace, was so clear and immediate that he sometimes wondered whether the image was really that of his child, so briefly but intently regarded, or whether he had taken into himself a prototype of dead childhood. His son would now be older than this child, would be entering the traumatic years of adolescence. He had convinced himself long ago that he was glad to have been spared them. But now it suddenly occurred to him that there was a whole territory of human experience on which, once repulsed, he had turned his back, and that this rejection somehow diminished him as a man. This transitory ache of loss surprised him by its intensity. He forced himself to consider a sensation so unfamiliar and unwelcome. Suddenly the child smiled at him and held out the ball. The effect was as disconcertingly flattering as when a stray cat would stalk toward him, tail erect, and condescend to be stroked. They gazed at each other. Dalgleesh smiled back. Then Massingham sprang forward and whipped the ball from the chubby hands. "Come on, football!" He began dribbling the blue and yellow ball across the lawn. Immediately the sturdy legs followed. The two of them disappeared around the side of the house, and Dalgleesh could hear the boys' high, cracked laughter. The girl gazed after them, her face suddenly pinched with loving anxiety. She turned to Dalgleesh. "I hope he knows not to kick it into the bonfire." It's almost out, but the embers are still very hot. I've been burning rubbish. Don't worry, he's a careful chap. And he's got younger brothers. She regarded him carefully for the first time. You're Commander Dalgleish, aren't you? We're Nell and William Kerrison. I'm afraid my father isn't here. I know. We've come to see your housekeeper, Miss Willard, isn't it? Is she in? I shouldn't take any notice of anything she says, if I were you. She's a dreadful liar, and she steals Daddy's drink. Don't you want to question William and me? A policewoman will be coming with us to talk to you both sometime when your father's at home. I won't see her. I don't mind talking to you, but I won't see a policewoman. I don't like social workers. A policewoman isn't a social worker. She's the same. She makes judgments on people, doesn't she? We had a social worker here after my mother left before the custody case, and she looked at William and me as if we were a public nuisance which someone had left on her doorstep. She went around the house, too, poking into things, pretending to admire, making out it was just a social visit. Policewomen and policemen never pretend that they're just paying a social visit. No one would believe us, would they? They turned and walked together toward the house. The girl said, "Are you going to discover who killed Dr. Lorimer?" "I hope so. I expect so." "And then what will happen to him? The murderer, I mean?"
"He'll appear before the magistrates. Then, if they think that the evidence is sufficient, they'll commit him to the Crown Court for trial."
"And then?"
"If he's found guilty of murder, the judge will pass the statutory penalty, imprisonment for life. That means he'll be in prison for a long time, perhaps 10 years or more."
"But that's silly. That won't put things right. It won't bring Dr. Lorimer back."
"It won't put anything right, but it isn't silly. Life is precious to nearly all of us. Even people who have little more than life still want to live it to the last natural moment. No one has the right to take it away from them."
"You talk as if life were like William's ball. If that's taken away, he knows what he's lost. Dr. Lorimer doesn't know that he's lost anything."
"He's lost the years he might have had."
"That's like taking away the ball that William might have had. Doesn't mean anything. It's just words. Suppose he was going to die next week anyway. Then he'd only have lost 7 days. You don't put someone in prison for 10 years to repay 7 lost days. They might not even have been happy days."
"Even if he were a very old man with 1 day left to him, the law says he has a right to live it. Willful killing would still be murder." The girl said thoughtfully,
"I suppose it was different when people believed in God.
Then the murdered person might have died in mortal sin and gone to hell. The 7 days could have made a difference then. He might have repented and had time for absolution."
Dalgleish said, "All these problems are easier for people who believe in God. Those of us who don't, or can't, have to do the best we can. That's what the law is, the best we can do. Human justice is imperfect, but it's the only justice we have."
"Are you sure you don't want to question me? I know that Daddy didn't kill him. He isn't a murderer. He was at home with William and me when Dr. Lorimer died. We put William to bed together at 7:30, and then we stayed with him for 20 minutes, and Daddy read Paddington Bear to him. Then I went to bed because I'd got a headache and wasn't feeling well, and Daddy brought me up a mug of cocoa, which he'd made specially for me. He sat by me reading poetry from my school anthology until he thought I'd gone to sleep, but I hadn't really. I was just pretending. He crept away just before 9, but I was still awake then. Shall I tell you how I know?"
"If you want to."
"Because I heard the church clock strike. Then Daddy left me, and I lay there in the dark, just thinking. He came back to look in at me again about 30 minutes later, but I still pretended to be asleep. So that lets Daddy out, doesn't it?"
"We don't know exactly when Dr. Lorimer died, but yes, I think it probably does.
Unless I'm telling you a lie."
"People very often do lie to the police. Are you?
No. But I expect I would if I thought it would save Daddy. I don't care about Dr. Lorimer, you see. I'm glad he's dead. He wasn't a nice man. The day before he died, William and I went to the lab to see Daddy. He was lecturing in the morning to the detective training course, and we thought we'd call for him before lunch. Inspector Blakelock let us sit in the hall, and that girl who helps him at the desk, the pretty one, smiled at William and offered him an apple from her lunchbox. And then Dr. Lorimer came down the stairs and saw us. I know it was he because the inspector spoke to him by his name, and he said, "What are those children doing in here? A lab isn't a place for children." I said, "I'm not a child. I'm Miss Eleanor Kerrison, and this is my brother William, and we're waiting for our father." He stared at us, as if he hated us, his face white and twitching. He said, "Well, you can't wait here." Then he spoke very unkindly to Inspector Blakelock. After Dr. Lorimer had gone, he said we'd better go, but he told William not to mind and took a sweet out of his left ear. "Did you know that the inspector was a conjurer?"
"No, I didn't know that."
"Would you like to see around the house before I take you to Miss Willard? Do you like seeing houses?"
"Very much, but I think perhaps not now."
"See the drawing room, anyway. It's much the best room. There, now. Isn't it lovely?"
The drawing room was in no sense lovely. It was a sombre, oak-panelled, over-furnished room, which looked as if little had changed since the days when the bombazine-clad wife and daughters of the Victorian rector sat there piously occupied with their parish sewing. The mullioned windows, framed by dark red, dirt-encrusted curtains, effectively excluded most of the daylight, so that Dalgliesh stepped into a sombre chilliness, which the sluggish fire did nothing to dispel. An immense mahogany table, bearing a jam-jar of chrysanthemums, stood against the far wall, and the fireplace, an ornate edifice of marble, was almost hidden by two immense saggy armchairs and a dilapidated sofa. Eleanor said with unexpected formality, as if the room had recalled her to her duty as a hostess, "I try to keep at least one room nice, in case we have visitors. The flowers are pretty, aren't they? William arranged them. Please sit down. Can I get you some coffee?" "That would be pleasant, but I don't think we ought to wait. We are really here to see Miss Willard." Massingham and William appeared in the doorway, flushed with their exercise, William with the ball tucked under his left arm. Eleanor led the way through a brass-studded green baize door and down a stone passage to the back of the house. William, deserting Massingham, trotted behind her, his plump hand clutching ineffectively at the skin-tight jeans. Pausing outside a door of unpolished oak, she said, "She's in here. She doesn't like William and me to go in. Anyway, she smells, so we don't." And taking William by the hand, she left them. Dalgliesh knocked. There was a rapid scrabbling noise inside the room, like an animal disturbed in its lair, and then the door was opened slightly, and a dark and suspicious eye looked out at them through the narrow aperture. Dalgliesh said, "Miss Willard, Commander Dalgliesh and Inspector Massingham from the Metropolitan Police. We're investigating Dr. Lorimer's murder. May we come in?" The eye softened. She gave a short, embarrassed gasp, rather like a snort, and opened the door wide.
"Of course, of course. What must you think of me? I'm afraid I'm still in what my dear old nurse used to call my disability. But I wasn't expecting you, and I usually have a quiet moment to myself about this time of the morning."
Eleanor was right. The room did smell. A smell Massingham diagnosed after a cautious sniff, composed of sweet sherry, unfresh body linen, and cheap scent. It was very hot. A small blue flame licked the red-hot ovals of coal briquettes banked high in the Victorian grate. The window, which gave a view of the garage and the wilderness that was the back garden, was open for only an inch at the top, despite the mildness of the day, and the air in the room pressed down on them, furred and heavy as a soiled blanket.
The room itself had a dreadful and perverse femininity. Everything looked moistly soft. The cretonne-covered seats of the two armchairs, the plump row of cushions along the back of a Victorian chaise longue, the imitation fur rug before the fire. The mantel shelf was cluttered with photographs in silver frames, mostly of a cassocked clergyman and his wife, whom Dalgliesh took to be Miss Willard's parents, standing side by side, but oddly dissociated, outside a variety of rather dull churches. Pride of place was held by a studio photograph of Miss Willard herself, young, toothily coy, the thick hair in waves. On a wall shelf to the right of the door was a small wood carving of an armless Madonna with the laughing child perched on her shoulder. A nightlight in a saucer was burning at her feet, casting a soft glow over the tender, drooping head and the sightless eye. Dalgliesh thought it was probably a copy, and a good one, of a medieval museum piece. Its gentle beauty emphasized the tawdriness of the room, yet dignified it, seeming to say that there was more than one kind of human loneliness, human pain, and that the same mercy embraced them all. Miss Willard waved them to the chaise longue.
"My own little den," she said gaily. "I like to be private, you know. I explained to Dr. Kerrison that I could only consider coming if I had my privacy. It's a rare and beautiful thing, don't you think? The human spirit wilts without it."
Looking at her hands, Dalgliesh thought she was probably in her middle 40s, although her face looked older. The dark hair, dry and coarse and tightly curled, was at odds with her faded complexion. Two sausages of curls over the brow suggested that she had hurriedly snatched out the rollers when she heard their knock. But her face was already made up. There was a circle of rouge under each eye, and the lipstick had seeped into the creases piercing her mouth. Her small, square, bony jaw was loose as a marionette's. She was not yet fully dressed, and a padded dressing gown of flowered nylon, stained with tea and what looked like egg, was corded over a nylon nightdress in bright blue with a grubby frill around the neck. Massingham was fascinated by a bulbous fold of limp cotton just above her shoes, from which he found it difficult to avert his eyes until he realized that she had put on her stockings back to front. She said,
"You want to talk to me about Dr. Kerrison's alibi, I expect." "Of course. It's quite ridiculous that he should have to provide one. A man so gentle, totally incapable of violence. But I can help you, as it happens. He was certainly at home until after 9, and I saw him again less than an hour later. But all this is just a waste of time. You bring a great reputation with you, Commander, but this is one crime that science can't solve. Not for nothing are they called the Black Fens. All through the centuries, evil has come out of this dank soil. We can fight evil, Commander, but not with your weapons."
Massingham said, "Well, suppose we begin by giving our weapons a chance." She looked at him and smiled pityingly.
"But all the doors were locked. All your clever scientific aids were intact. No one broke in, and no one could have got out. And yet he was struck down. That was no human hand, Inspector."
Dalgliesh said, "It was almost certainly a blunt weapon, Miss Willard, and I've no doubt there was a human hand at the end of it. It's our job to find out whose, and I hope that you may be able to help us. You housekeep for Dr. Kerrison and his daughter, I believe." Miss Willard disposed on him a glance in which pity at such ignorance was mixed with gentle reproof.
"I am not a housekeeper, Commander. Certainly not a housekeeper. Shall we say that I'm a working house guest? Dr. Kerrison needed someone to live in so that the children weren't left alone when he was called out to a murder scene. They're children of a broken marriage, I'm afraid. The old, sad story. You are not married, Commander?"
"No."
"How wise!"
She sighed, conveying in the sibilant release of breath infinite yearning, infinite regret. Dalgliesh persevered.
"So you live completely separately?" "My own little quarters. This sitting room and a bedroom next door. My own small kitchenette through this door here. I won't show it to you now, because it's not quite as I should like it to be."
"What precisely are the domestic arrangements, Miss Willard?"
"They get their own breakfast. The doctor usually lunches at the hospital, of course. Nell and William have something on a tray when she bothers to prepare it, and I look after myself. Then I cook a little something for everyone in the evenings, quite simple. We're none of us large eaters. We eat very early because of William. It's more a high tea, really. Nell and her father do all the cooking during the weekend. It really works out quite well."
"Quite well for you," thought Massingham. Certainly William had seemed sturdy and well-nourished enough, but the girl ought to be at school, not struggling, almost unaided, with this isolated and cheerless monstrosity of a house. He wondered how she got on with Miss Willard. As if reading his thoughts, Miss Willard said,
"William is a sweet little boy. Absolutely no trouble. I hardly see him, really. But Nell is difficult. Very difficult. Girls of her age usually are. She needs a mother's firm hand. You know, of course, that Mrs. Kerrison walked out on her husband a year ago. She ran away with one of his colleagues at the hospital. It broke him up completely. Now she's trying to get the High Court to reverse the custody order and give her the children when the divorce is heard in a month's time. And I'm sure it'll be a good thing if they do. Children ought to be with their mother. Not that Nell's really a child any longer. It's the boy they're fighting over, not Nell. If you ask me, neither of them cares about her. She gives her father a terrible time of it. Nightmares, screaming attacks, asthma. He's going to London next Monday for a 3-day conference on forensic pathology. I'm afraid she'll make him pay for that little jaunt when he gets back. Neurotic, you know. Punishing him for loving her brother more. Although, of course, he can't see that."
Dalgliesh wondered by what mental process she had arrived at that glib psychological assessment. Not, he thought, that it was necessarily wrong. He felt profoundly sorry for Kerrison. Suddenly Massingham felt sick. The warmth and feculent smell of the room overpowered him. A blob of cold sweat dropped onto his notebook. Muttering an apology, he strode over to the window and tugged at the frame. It resisted for a moment, then slammed down. Great draughts of cool, reviving air poured in. The frail light before the carved Madonna flickered and went out. When he got back to his notebook, Dalgliesh was already asking about the previous evening. Miss Willard said that she had cooked a meal of minced beef, potatoes and frozen peas for supper, with a blancmange to follow. She had washed up alone, and had then gone to say good night to the family before returning to her sitting room. They were then in the drawing room, but Dr. Kerrison and Nell were about to take William up to bed. She had seen and heard nothing else of the family until just after 9 o'clock, when she had gone to check that the front door was bolted. Dr. Kerrison was sometimes careless about locking up, and didn't always appreciate how nervous she felt, sleeping alone and on the ground floor. One read such terrible stories. She had passed the study door, which was ajar, and had heard Dr. Kerrison speaking on the telephone. She had returned to her sitting room and had switched on the television. Dr. Kerrison had looked in shortly before 10 o'clock to talk to her about a small increase in her salary, but they had been interrupted by a telephone call. He had returned 10 minutes or so later, and they had been together for about half an hour. It had been pleasant to have the opportunity of a private chat without the children butting in. Then he had said good night and left her. She had switched on the television again and had watched it until nearly midnight, when she had gone to bed. If Dr. Kerrison had taken out the car, she felt fairly sure that she would have heard it, since her sitting-room window looked out at the garage which was built at the side of the house. Well, they could see that for themselves. She had overslept the next morning, and hadn't breakfasted until after 9. She had been woken by the telephone ringing. But it hadn't been until Dr. Kerrison returned from the laboratory that she knew about Dr. Lorimer's murder. Dr. Kerrison had returned briefly to the house, shortly after 9 o'clock, to tell her and Nell what had happened, and to ring the hospital to say that any calls for him should be transferred to the reception desk at the laboratory. Dalgleish said, "I believe Dr. Lorimer used to drive you to 11 o'clock service at St. Mary's at Guy's Marsh. He seems to have been a solitary and not a very happy man. No one seems to have known him well. I was wondering whether he found in you the companionship and friendship he seems to have lacked in his working life." Massingham looked up, curious to see her response to this blatant invitation to self-revelation. She hooded her eyes like a bird, while a red blotch spread like a contagion over her throat. She said, with an attempt at archness,
"Now, I'm afraid you're teasing me, Commander." "It is Commander, isn't it? It seems so odd, just like a naval rank. My late brother-in-law was in the Navy, so I know a little of these matters. But you were talking of friendship. That implies confidence. I should like to have helped him, but he wasn't easy to know. And there was the age difference. I'm not so very much older, less than 5 years, I suppose, but it's a great deal to a comparatively young man. No, I'm afraid we were just two reprobate high Anglicans in this evangelical swampland. We didn't even sit together in church. I've always sat in the third pew down from the pulpit, and he liked to be right at the back."
Dalgleish persisted. "But he must have enjoyed your company. He called for you every Sunday, didn't he?"
"Only because Father Gregory asked him. There is a bus to Guy's Marsh, but I have to wait half an hour. And as Dr. Lorimer drove past the old rectory, Father Gregory suggested that it would be a sensible arrangement if we travelled together. He never came in. I was always ready and waiting for him outside the drive. If his father were ill, or he himself was out on a case, he'd telephone. Sometimes he wasn't able to let me know, which was inconvenient. But I knew that if he didn't drive up at 10:40, he wouldn't be coming, and then I set off for the bus. Usually, of course, he came, except during the first 6 months of this year, when he gave up Mass. But he rang early in September to say that he would be stopping for me, as he used to. Naturally, I never questioned him about the break. One does go through these dark nights of the soul."
So he had stopped going to Mass when the affair with Domenica Schofield began, and had resumed his church going after the break. Dalgleish asked, "Did he take the sacrament?" She was unsurprised by the question.
"Not since he started coming to Mass again in mid-September. It worried me a little, I confess. I did wonder whether to suggest to him that if anything was troubling him, he should have a talk with Father Gregory. But one is on very delicate ground, and it really wasn't any concern of mine."
And she wouldn't want to offend him, thought Massingham. Those lifts in the car must have been very convenient. Dalgleish asked, "So he did very occasionally telephone you. Have you ever rung him?" She turned away and fussed, plumping up a cushion.
"Dear me, no. Why should I? I don't even know his number."
Massingham said, "It seems odd that he went to church at Guy's Marsh instead of in the village." Miss Willard looked at him severely.
"Not at all.
Mr. Swaffield is a very worthy man, but he's low, very low. The Fens have always been strongly evangelical. When my dear father was rector here, he had constant fights with the parochial church council over reservation. And then I think that Dr. Lorimer didn't want to get drawn into church and village activities. It's so difficult not to, once you're known as a regular member of the congregation. Father Gregory didn't expect that. He realized that Dr. Lorimer had his own father to care for, and a very demanding job. Incidentally, I was very distressed that the police didn't call for Father Gregory.
Someone should have called a priest to the body.
Dalgliesh said gently, he had been dead some hours when the body was discovered, Miss Willard.
Even so, he should have had a priest.
She stood up, as if signifying that the interview was at an end.
Dalgliesh was glad enough to go. He said his formal thanks and asked Miss Willard to get in touch with him immediately if anything of interest occurred to her. He and Massingham were at the door when she suddenly called out imperiously, "Young man!"
The two detectives turned to look at her. She spoke directly to Massingham, like an old-fashioned nurse admonishing a child.
"Would you please shut the window which you so inconsiderately opened, and relight the candle?"
Meekly, as if in obedience to long-forgotten nursery commands, Massingham did so. They were left to find their own way out of the house, and saw no one. When they were in the car, fastening their seat belts, Massingham exploded.
"Good God! You'd think Kerrison could find someone more suitable than that old hag to care for his children. She's a slut, a dipsomaniac, and she's half mad."
"It's not so simple for Kerrison. A remote village, a large, cold house, and a daughter who can't be easy to cope with. Faced with the choice of that kind of job and the dole, most women today would probably opt for the dole. Did you take a look at the bonfire?"
"Nothing there. It looks as if they are periodically burning a lot of old furniture and garden rubbish, which they've got stacked in one of the coach houses. William said that Nell made a bonfire early this morning."
"William can talk, then?" Dalgliesh asked.
"Oh, William can talk. But I'm not sure that you'd be able to understand him, sir."
"Did you believe Miss Willard when she gave that alibi for Kerrison?"
"I'm as ready to believe her as I am Mrs. Bradley or Mrs. Blakelock when they confirm Bradley's and Blakelock's alibis. Who can tell? We know that Kerrison did ring Dr. Collingwood at 9 and was here to receive his call at about 10. If Miss Willard sticks to her story, he's in the clear for that hour, and I've a feeling that it's the crucial hour. But how did he know that? And if he did, why suppose that we should be able to pin down the time of death so precisely? Sitting with his daughter until 9, and then calling on Miss Willard just before 10, looks very like an attempt to establish that he was at home during the whole of that hour." Massingham said, "He must have been, to take that 10 o'clock call. And I don't see how he could have got to Hoggart's, killed Lorimer, and returned home in less than 60 minutes, not if he went on foot. And Miss Willard seems confident that he didn't take the car. I suppose it would just be possible if he took a short cut through the new laboratory. It would be a close thing." Just then the car radio beeped. Dalgliesh took the call. It was from the Guy's Marsh control room to say that Sergeant Reynolds at the lab wanted to contact them. The Met Lab report had been received.
Chapter 4.
They opened the door together. Mrs. Bradley held a sleeping child in her arms. Bradley said, "Come in. It's about the vomit, isn't it? I've been expecting you." They moved into the sitting room. He gestured Dalgliesh and Massingham to the two chairs and sat down on the sofa opposite them. His wife moved close to him, shifting the baby's weight against her shoulder. Dalgliesh asked, "Do you want a solicitor?"
"No. Not yet, anyway. I'm ready to tell the whole truth, and it can't hurt me. At least I suppose it can lose me my job, but that's the worst it can do. And I think I'm almost beyond caring."
Massingham opened his notebook. Dalgliesh said to Susan Bradley, "Wouldn't you like to put the baby in her pram, Mrs. Bradley?" She gazed at Dalgliesh with blazing eyes and shook her head vehemently, holding the child more tightly, as if she expected them to tear her from her arms.
Massingham was grateful that at least the child was asleep, but he wished that neither she nor her mother were there. He looked at the baby, bunched in her pink sleeping suit against her mother's shoulder, the fringe of longer hair above the tender, hollowed neck, the round, bare patch at the back of the head, the close-shut eyes and ridiculous, snubbed nose. The frail mother with her milky bundle was more inhibiting than a whole firm of recalcitrant anti-police lawyers. There was a lot to be said for bundling a suspect into the back of a police car and taking him off to the station to make his statement in the functional anonymity of the interrogation room. Even the Bradley sitting room provoked in him a mixture of irritation and pity. It still smelled new and unfinished. There was no fireplace, and the television held pride of place above the wall-mounted electric heater, with, above it, a popular print of waves dashing against a rocky shore. The wall opposite had been prepared to match the flowered curtains, but the other three were bare, the plaster already beginning to crack. There was a metal baby's high chair, and underneath it a spread of plastic sheeting to protect the carpet. Everything looked new, as if they had brought to their marriage no accumulation of small personal impedimenta, had come spiritually naked into possession of this small, characterless room. Dalgleish said, "We'll take it that your previous account of your movements on Wednesday night wasn't true, or was incomplete. So what did happen?" Massingham wondered for a moment why Dalgleish wasn't cautioning Bradley. Then he thought he knew. Bradley might have had the guts to kill if provoked beyond endurance, but he'd never have had the nerve to drop from that third-floor window. And if he didn't, how did he get out of the laboratory? Lorimer's killer had either used the keys or he had made that climb. All their investigations, all their careful and repeated examinations of the building had confirmed that hypothesis. There was no other way. Bradley looked at his wife. She gave him a brief transforming smile and held out her free hand. He clasped it, and they edged closer. He moistened his lips and then began speaking as if the speech had been long rehearsed. "On Tuesday, Dr. Lorimer finished writing my annual confidential report. He told me he wanted to talk to me about it the next day, before he passed it to Dr. Howarth, and he called me into his private room soon after he arrived in the lab. He'd given me an adverse report, and according to the rules, he had to explain why. I wanted to defend myself, but I couldn't, and there wasn't any real privacy. I felt that the whole laboratory knew what was happening and was listening and waiting. Besides, I was so frightened of him. I don't know why exactly. I can't explain it. He had such an effect on me that he'd only have to be working close to me in the laboratory and I'd start shaking. When he was away at a scene of crime, it was like heaven. I could work perfectly well then. The annual confidential report wasn't unjust. I knew that my work had deteriorated. But he was partly the reason why. He seemed to take my inadequacy as a personal denigration of himself. Poor work was just intolerable to him. He was obsessed by my mistakes, and because I was so terrified, I made them all the more." He paused for a moment. No one spoke. Then he went on. "We weren't going to the village concert because we couldn't get a babysitter. And anyway, Sue's mother was coming for supper. I got home just before 6. After the meal, the curry and rice and peas, I saw her off on the 7:45 bus. I came straight back here. But I kept thinking of the adverse report, what Dr. Howarth would say, what was I going to do if he recommended a move, how we could possibly sell this house. We had to buy when prices were at their peak, and it's almost impossible to find buyers now, except at a loss. Besides, I didn't think another lab would want me. After a time, I thought I'd go back to the laboratory and confront him. I think I had some idea that we might be able to communicate, that I could speak to him as another human being and make him understand how I felt. Anyway, I felt that I would go mad if I stayed indoors. I had to walk somewhere.
and I walked towards Hoggart's. I didn't tell Sue what I was going to do, and she tried to persuade me not to go out, but I went. He looked up at Dalgliesh and said, "Can I have a drink of water?" Without a word, Massingham got up and went to find the kitchen. He couldn't see the glasses, but there were two washed cups on the drain board. He filled one with cold water and brought it back to Bradley. Bradley drained it. He drew his hand over his moist mouth and went on. "I didn't see anyone on the way to the laboratory. People don't walk out in this village much after dark. And I suppose most of them were at the concert. There was a light on in the hall of the laboratory. I rang the bell and Lorimer came. He seemed surprised to see me, but I said I wanted to speak to him. He looked at his watch and said he could only spare me 5 minutes. I followed him up to the biology lab." He looked across directly at Dalgliesh. He said, "It was a strange sort of interview. I sensed that he was impatient and wanted to get rid of me, and part of the time I thought that he hardly listened to what I was saying or even knew that I was there. I didn't make a good job of it. I tried to explain that I wasn't being careless on purpose, that I really liked the work and wanted to make a success of it and be a credit to the department. I tried to explain the effect he had on me." I don't know whether he was listening. He stood there with his eyes fixed on the floor. And then he looked up and began speaking. He didn't really look at me. He was looking through me, almost as if I weren't there. And he was saying things, terrible things, as if they were words in a play, nothing to do with me. I kept hearing the same words over and over again. Failure, useless, hopeless, inadequate. He even said something about marriage. I think he was mad. I can't explain what it was like, all this hate pouring out, hate and misery and despair. I stood there shaking with this stream of words pouring over me as if it were filth. And then his eyes focused on me, and I knew that he was seeing me, Clifford Bradley. His voice sounded quite different. He said, "You're a third-rate biologist and a fourth-rate forensic scientist. That's what you were when you came into this department, and you'll never change. I have two alternatives, to check every one of your results, or to risk the service and this laboratory being discredited in court. Neither is tolerable. So I suggest that you look for another job. And now I've things to do, so please leave." He turned his back on me and I went out. I knew that it was impossible. It would have been better not to have come. He'd never told me before exactly what he thought of me, and not in those words anyway. I felt sick and miserable, and I knew I was crying. That made me despise myself the more. I stumbled upstairs to the men's cloakroom and was just able to reach the first basin before I vomited. I don't remember how long I stood there, leaning over the basin, half crying and half vomiting. I suppose it could have been 3 or 4 minutes. After a time, I put on the cold tap and swilled my face. Then I tried to pull myself together. But I was still shaking, and I felt sick. I went and sat on one of the lavatory seats and sank my head in my hands. I don't know how long I was there. 10 minutes, perhaps. But it could have been longer. I knew I could never change his opinion of me, never make him understand. He wasn't like a human being. I realized that he hated me. But now I began to hate him, and in a different way. I'd have to leave. I knew he'd see to that. But at least I could tell him what I thought of him. I could behave like a man. So I went down the stairs and into the biology laboratory. Again he paused. The child stirred in her mother's arms and gave a little cry in her sleep. Susan Bradley began an automatic jogging and crooning, but kept her eyes on her husband. Then Bradley went on. He was lying between the two middle examination tables, face downward. I didn't wait to see whether he was dead. I know that I ought to feel dreadful about that, about the fact that I left him without getting help. But I don't. I can't make myself feel sorry. But at the time, I wasn't glad that he was dead. I wasn't aware of any feeling except terror. I hurled myself downstairs and out of the laboratory as if his murderer were after me. The door was still on the Yale, and I know that I must have drawn back the bottom bolt, but I can't remember. I raced down the drive. I think there was a bus passing, but it had started up before I reached the gate. When I got into the road, it was disappearing. Then I saw a car approaching, and instinctively I stood back in the shadows of the walls. The car slowed down and turned into the laboratory drive. Then I made myself walk slowly and normally. And the next thing I remember was being home. Susan Bradley spoke for the first time. Clifford told me all about it. But of course he had to. He looked so terrible that I knew something awful must have happened. We decided together what we'd better do. We knew that he'd had nothing to do with what happened to Dr. Lorimer. But who would believe Cliff? Everyone in the department knew what Dr. Lorimer thought of him. He would be bound to be suspected anyway, and if you found out that he was there, in the laboratory, and at the very moment it happened, then how could he hope to persuade you that he wasn't guilty? So we decided to say that we'd been together the whole evening. My mother did ring about 9 o'clock to say that she'd got safely home, and I told her that Cliff was having a bath. She'd never really liked my marriage, and I didn't want to admit to her that he was out. She'd only start criticising him for leaving me and the baby. So we knew that she could confirm what I'd said, and that might be some help, even though she hadn't spoken to him. And then Cliff remembered about the vomit. Her husband went on, almost eagerly now, as if willing them to understand and believe. I knew I'd swilled cold water over my face, but I couldn't be certain that the bowl was clean. The more I thought about it, the more sure I was that it was stained with vomit, and I knew how much you could learn from that. I'm a secretor, but that didn't worry me. I knew that stomach acids would destroy the antibodies, and that the lab wouldn't be able to determine my blood group, but there was the curry powder, the dye in the peas. They'd be able to say enough about that last meal to identify me. And I couldn't lie about what we'd had for supper because Sue's mother had been sharing it with us. So we had this idea of trying to stop Mrs. Bidwell going early to the laboratory. I always get to work before 9, so I would be the first on the scene, quite naturally. If I went straight to the washroom, as I normally would, and cleaned the bowl, then the only evidence that I was in the lab the previous evening would be gone forever. No one would ever know. Susan Bradley said, "It was my idea to phone Mrs. Bidwell, and I was the one who spoke to her husband. We knew that she wouldn't answer the phone. She never did. But Cliff hadn't realised that old Mr. Lorimer wasn't entering hospital the previous day. He was out of the department when old Mr. Lorimer rang. So the plan went all wrong. Mr. Lorimer telephoned Inspector Blakelock, and everyone arrived at the lab almost as soon as Cliff. After that, there was nothing we could do but wait." Dalgliesh could imagine how terrible that time of waiting had been. No wonder that Bradley hadn't been able to face going into the lab. He asked, "When you rang the bell at the laboratory, how long was it before Dr. Lorimer answered?" "Almost immediately. He couldn't have come down from the biology department. He must have been somewhere on the ground floor." "Did he say anything at all about expecting a visitor?" The temptation was obvious, but Bradley said, "No. He talked about having things to do, but I took it that he meant the analysis he was working on." "And when you found the body, you saw and heard nothing of the murderer?" "No. I didn't wait to look, of course. But I'm sure he was there, and very close. I don't know why." "Did you notice the position of the mallet? The fact that there was a page missing from Lorimer's notebook?" "No, nothing. All I can remember is Lorimer, the body, and the thin stream of blood." "When you were in the washroom, did you hear the doorbell?" "No, but I don't think I could have heard it, not above the first floor. And I'm sure I wouldn't have heard it while I was being sick." "When Dr. Lorimer opened the door to you, did anything strike you as unusual apart from the fact that he came so promptly.
Nothing, except that he was carrying his notebook.
Are you quite sure?
Yes, I'm sure. It was folded back.
So, Bradley's arrival had interrupted what it was that Lorimer had been doing. And he had been on the ground floor, the floor with the director's office, the records department, the exhibits store.
Dalglish said, "The car that turned into the drive as you left, what sort of car?"
"I didn't see. All I can remember are the headlights. We don't have a car, and I'm not clever at recognising the different models unless I get a clear look."
"Can you remember how it was driven? Did the driver turn into the drive confidently, as if he knew where he was going, or did he hesitate, as if he were looking for a convenient spot to stop and happened to see the open driveway?"
"He just slowed down a little and drove straight in. I think it was someone who knew the place, but I didn't wait to see if he drove up to the lab. Next day, of course, I knew that it couldn't have been the police from Guy's Marsh or anyone with a key, or the body would have been discovered earlier."
He looked at Dalglish with his anxious eyes. "What will happen to me now? I can't face them at the lab."
"Inspector Massingham will drive you to Guy's Marsh police station so that you can make a formal statement and sign it. I'll explain to Dr. Howarth what has happened. Whether you go back to the lab and when must be for him and your establishment department to say. I imagine they may decide to give you special leave until this affair is settled."
If it ever were settled, if Bradley were telling the truth, they now knew that Lorimer had died between 8:45, when his father had telephoned him, and just before 9:11, when the Guy's Marsh bus had moved away from the Chevisham stop. The clue of the vomit had fixed for them the time of death, had solved the mystery of the call to Mrs. Bidwell. But it hadn't pointed them to a murderer. And if Bradley were innocent, what sort of life would he have inside or outside the Forensic Science Service unless the case were solved? He watched Massingham and Bradley on their way, then set out to walk the half mile back to Hoggart's, not relishing the prospect of his interview with Howarth. Glancing back, he saw that Susan Bradley was still standing at the doorway, looking after him, her baby in her arms.
Chapter 5. Howarth said, "I'm not going to trot out the usual platitude about blaming myself. I don't believe in that spurious acceptance of vicarious liability. All the same, I ought to have known that Bradley was near breaking point. I suspect that old Dr. McIntyre wouldn't have let this happen. And now I'd better telephone the establishment department. I expect they'll want him to stay at home for the present. It's particularly inconvenient from the point of view of the work. They need every pair of hands they can get in the biology department. Claire Easterbrook is taking on as much of Lorimer's work as she can manage, but there's a limit to what she can do. At the moment she's busy with the clunch pit analysis. She's insisting on starting the electrophoresis again. I don't blame her. She's the one who'll have to give evidence. She can only speak for her own results."
Dalglish asked what was likely to happen about Clifford Bradley.
"Oh, there'll be a regulation to cover the circumstances somewhere. There always is. He'll be dealt with by the usual compromise between expediency and humanity. Unless, of course, you propose to arrest him for murder, in which case, administratively speaking, the problem will solve itself. By the way, the public relations branch has rung. You probably haven't had time to see today's press. Some of the papers are getting rather agitated about the lab security. Are our blood samples safe? And one of the Sundays has commissioned an article on science in the service of crime. They're sending someone to see me at 3 o'clock. Public relations would like a word with you, incidentally. They're hoping to lay on another press conference later this afternoon." When Howarth had left, Dalglish joined Sergeant Underhill and occupied himself with the 4 large bundles of files which Brenda Pridmore had provided. It was extraordinary
How many of 6,000 cases and nearly 25,000 exhibits, which the laboratory dealt with each year, had the numbers 1840 or 1840 in their registration? The cases came from all the departments: biology, toxicology, criminalistics, document examination, blood alcohol analysis, vehicle examination. Nearly every scientist in the laboratory, above the level of higher scientific officer, had been concerned in them. All of them seemed perfectly in order. He was still convinced that the mysterious telephone message to Lorimer held the clue to the mystery of his death. But it seemed increasingly unlikely that the numbers, if old Mr. Lorimer had remembered them correctly, bore any reference to a file registration. By 3 o'clock, he had decided to put the task on one side and see if physical exercise would stimulate his brain. It was time, he thought, to walk through the grounds and take a look at the Wren Chapel. He was reaching for his coat when the telephone rang. It was Massingham from Geismar Station. The car that had parked in Hoggart's Drive on Wednesday night had at last been traced. It was a grey Cortina belonging to a Mrs. Maureen Doyle. Mrs. Doyle was at present staying with her parents in Ilford in Essex, but she had confirmed that the car was hers and that, on the night of the murder, it had been driven by her husband, Detective Inspector Doyle. Chapter 6. The interview room at Guy's Marsh Police Station was small, stuffy, and overcrowded. Superintendent Mercer, with his great bulk, was taking up more than his share of space, and, it seemed to Massingham, breathing more than his share of the air. Of the 5 men present, including the shorthand writer, Doyle himself appeared both the most comfortable and the least concerned. Dalgleish was questioning him. Mercer stood against the mullioned windows. "You were at Hoggart's last night. There are fresh tyre marks in the earth under the trees to the right of the entrance. Your tyre marks. If you want to waste time for both of us, you can look at the casts."
"I admit that they're my tyre marks. I parked there briefly on Monday night."
"Why?" The question was so quiet, so reasonable. He might have had a genuine human interest to know.
"I was with someone."
He paused and then added, "Sir,
I hope for your sake that you were with someone last night. Even an embarrassing alibi is better than none. You quarrelled with Lorimer. You're one of the few people he would have let into the lab. And you parked your car under the trees. If you didn't murder him, why are you trying to persuade us that you did?"
"You don't really believe I killed him. Probably you already suspect or know who did. You can't frighten me, because I know you haven't any evidence. There isn't any to get. I was driving the Cortina because the clutch had gone on the Renault, not because I didn't want to be recognised. I was with Sergeant Beale until 8 o'clock. We'd been to interview a man called Barry Taylor at Muddington, and then we went on to see one or two other people who'd been at the dance last Tuesday. From 8 o'clock, I was driving alone, and where I went was my own business."
"Not when it's a case of murder. Isn't that what you tell your suspects when they come out with that good old bromide about the sanctity of their private lives? You can do better than that, Doyle."
"I wasn't at the lab on Wednesday night. Those tyre marks were made when I parked there last Monday."
"The Dunlop on the left-hand back wheel is new. It was fitted on Monday afternoon by Goringer's garage. And your wife didn't collect the Cortina until 10 o'clock on Wednesday morning."
"If you didn't drive to Hoggart's to see Lorimer, then what were you doing there? And if your business was legitimate, then why park just inside the entrance and under the trees?"
"If I'd been there to murder Lorimer, I'd have parked in one of the garages at the back. That would have been safer than leaving the Cortina in the drive. And I didn't get to Hoggart's until after 9. I knew that Lorimer would be working late on the clutch pit case, but not that late. The lab was in darkness. The truth, if you must know, is that I'd picked up a woman at the crossroads just outside Mynheer. I wasn't in any hurry to get home, and I wanted somewhere quiet and secluded to stop. The lab seemed as good a place as any. We were there from about 9:15 until 9:55, and no one left during that time. He had taken his time over what was presumably intended to be a quick one-night lay, thought Massingham. Dalgleish asked, "Did you trouble to find out who she was, exchanging names?" "I told her that I was Ronnie McDowell. It seemed as good a name as any. She said she was Dora Meekin. I don't suppose that more than one of us was lying." "And that's all? Not where she lived or worked?" "She said she worked at the sugar beet factory and lived in a cottage near the ruined engine house on Hunter's Fen. That's about 3 miles from Anea. She said she was a widow. Like a little gentleman, I dropped her at the bottom of the lane leading to Hunter's Fen. If she wasn't telling me a yarn, that should be enough to find her." Chief Superintendent Mercer said grimly, "I hope for your sake that it is. You know what this means for you, of course." Doyle laughed. It was a surprisingly light-hearted sound. "Oh, I know, all right. But don't let that worry you. I'm handing in my resignation, and from now." Dalgleish asked, "Are you sure about the lights? The lab was in darkness." "I shouldn't have stopped there if it hadn't been. There wasn't a light to be seen. And although I admit I was somewhat preoccupied for a minute or two, I could swear that no one came down that drive while we were there."
"Or out of the front door?"
"That would be possible, I suppose. But the drive isn't more than 40 yards long, I'd say. I think I'd have noticed, unless he slipped out very quickly. I doubt whether anyone would have risked it, not if he'd seen my headlights and knew that the car was there." Dalgleish looked at Mercer. He said, "We've got to get back to Chevisham. We'll take in Hunter's Fen on the way." Chapter 7. Leaning over the back of the Victorian chaise longue, Angela Foley was massaging her friend's neck. The coarse hairs tickled the back of her hands. As firmly and gently she kneaded the taut muscles, feeling for each separate vertebra under the hot, tense skin. Stella sat, head slumped forward in her hands. Neither spoke. Outside, a light, scavenging wind was blowing fitfully over the fens, stirring the fallen leaves on the patio and gusting the thin white wood smoke from the cottage chimney. But inside the sitting room all was quiet, except for the crackling of the fire, the ticking of the grandfather clock, and the sound of their breathing. The cottage was full of the pungent, resinous aroma of burning applewood, overlaid with the savoury smell from the kitchen of beef casserole reheated from yesterday's dinner. After a few minutes, Angela Foley said, "Better? Would you like a cold compress on your forehead?" "No, that's lovely. Almost gone, in fact. Odd that I only get a headache on those days when the book has gone particularly well. Another 2 minutes, then I'd better see about dinner." Angela flexed her fingers and bent again to her task. Stella's voice, muffled in her sweater, suddenly said, "What was it like, as a child, being in local authority care?" "I'm not sure that I know. I mean, I wasn't in a home or anything like that. They fostered me most of the time." "Well, what was that like? You've never really told me." "It was all right." "No, that's not true. It was like living in a second-rate boarding house where they don't want you, and you know that you won't be able to pay the bill. Until I met you and came here, I felt like that all the time, not really at home in the world. I suppose my foster parents were kind. They meant to be. But I wasn't pretty, and I wasn't grateful. It can't be much fun fostering other people's children, and I suppose one does rather look for gratitude. Looking back, I can see that I wasn't much joy for them, plain and surly. I once heard a neighbour say to my third foster mother that I looked just like a fetus with my bulging forehead and tiny features. I resented the other children because they had mothers and I hadn't.
I've never really outgrown that. It's despicable. But I even dislike Brenda Pridmore, the new girl on our reception desk, because she's so obviously a loved child. She's got a proper home. So have you now. But I know what you mean. By the age of 5, you've either learned that the world is good and everything and everyone in it stretches out towards you with love, or you know that you're a reject. No one ever unlearns that first lesson. I have because of you, Star. Don't you think we ought to start looking for another cottage, perhaps nearer Cambridge? There's bound to be a job there for a qualified secretary. We're not going to need another cottage. I telephoned my publishers this afternoon, and I think it's going to be all right.
Hearn and Collingwood?
But how can it be all right? I thought you said, it's going to be all right.
Suddenly Stella shook herself free of the ministering hands and stood up. She went into the passage and came back, her duffel coat over her shoulder, her boots in hand. She moved over to the fireside chair and began to pull them on. Angela Foley watched her without speaking. Then Stella took from her jacket pocket a brown, opened envelope and tossed it across. It fell on the velvet of the chaise longue.
"Oh, I meant to show you this."
Puzzled, Angela took out the single folded sheet. She said,
"Where did you find this?"
"I took it from Edwin's desk when I was rummaging about for the will. I thought at the time that I might have a use for it. Now I've decided that I haven't."
"But, Star, you should have left it for the police to find. It's a clue. They'll have to know."
"This was probably what Edwin was doing that night, checking up. It's important. We can't keep it to ourselves."
"Then you'd better go back to Post Mill Cottage and pretend to find it. Otherwise it's going to be a bit embarrassing explaining how we came by it."
"But the police aren't going to believe that. They wouldn't have missed it. I wonder when it arrived at the lab. It's odd that he took it home with him and didn't even lock it up."
"Why should he? There was only the one locked drawer in his desk. And I don't suppose anyone, even his father, ever went into that room."
"But, Star, this could explain why he was killed. This could be a motive for murder."
"Oh, I don't think so. It's just a gratuitous bit of spite, anonymous, proving nothing. Edwin's death was both simpler and more complicated than that. Murder usually is. But the police might see it as a motive. And I agree that it would be convenient for us. I'm beginning to think I should have left it where it was."
She had pulled on her boots and was ready to go. Angela Foley said,
"You know who killed him, don't you?"
"Does that shock you, that I haven't rushed to confide in that extraordinarily personable commander?"
Angela whispered,
"What are you going to do?"
"Nothing. I've no proof. Let the police do the work they're paid for. I might have had more public spirit when we had the death penalty. I'm not afraid of the ghosts of hanged men. They can stand at the four corners of my bed and howl all night if it pleases them. But I couldn't go on living, I couldn't go on working, which amounts to the same thing for me, knowing that I'd put another human being in prison, and for life. Not really for life, about 10 years. I couldn't stand it for 10 days. I'm going out now. I shan't be long."
"But, Star, it's nearly 7. We were going to eat."
"The casserole won't spoil."
Angela Foley watched silently as her friend went to the door. Then she said,
"Star, how did you know about Edwin practicing his evidence the night before he had to go into the box?"
"If you didn't tell me, and you say that you didn't, then I must have invented it. I couldn't have learned it from anyone else. You'd better put it down to creative imagination."
Her hand was on the door. Angela cried out,
"Star, don't go out tonight. Stay with me. I'm afraid."
"For yourself or for me?"
"For both of us. Please don't go. Not tonight."
Stella turned. She smiled and spread her hands in what could have been a gesture of resignation or a farewell. There was a howl of wind, a rush of cold air as the front door opened. Then the sound of its closing echoed through the cottage, and Stella was gone.
This ends Disc 8.